ready to hear from you when you are ready, and which has probably been a while now, and then would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes, yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chris Chanoval for the Commonwealth. The issue in this case is, of course, whether Mr. Acosta Moreno knowingly and intelligently waived his Miranda rights before he proceeded to have an hour and a half conversation with Lieutenant Darcy. And, of course, that question is judged under the plainly wrong standard, whether the ultimate conclusion was plainly wrong, and whether the factual findings leading up to that conclusion were plainly wrong.
Right.
The Commonwealth would submit that in this case, if the Court were to compare Lieutenant Darcy's testimony on page 72 of the appendix with the trial court's ultimate factual findings on page 106 of the appendix, that the court's factual findings really could not be more plainly wrong than they were here.
Let me ask you, this is Judge Huff. Let's assume that for the moment. Aren't there other factors that would still support and thereby overcome the plainly wrong standard that you already mentioned, factors such as the defendant was a native of El Salvador, he'd picked up some English informally but had not had any schooling in it, he'd refused to sign the card because he didn't read English, his understanding was that they were just having a conversation, his girlfriend testified that sometimes he needed things explained to him and didn't have the technical knowledge. He'd never been exposed to the criminal justice system. I mean, aren't those factors enough to support the finding of the trial court, notwithstanding that the judge may or may not have gotten that one statement wrong?
Right. I would submit that given the importance of the plainly wrong factual findings the trial court made, that those other factors are not sufficient for a couple of reasons. First of all, is the fact that the plainly wrong factual findings that the court made, the Commonwealth submits, would have tainted, very likely tainted, all other factual findings that the court then went on to make. The court kind of made a preliminary factual finding that the lieutenant's testimony was more or less equivocal, more or less canceled each other out, because on the one hand, he testified that, yes, he thought the defendant was conversing sufficiently in English, but then according to the trial court's notes, he also testified that there were some misunderstandings and he had to go back and re-explain certain questions. And of course, we know from his testimony, he testified to the exact opposite, that there were no misunderstandings. He did not have to go back and explain anything. But because the trial court...
I thought that it was he could not recall any.
He testified that he could not recall there being any misunderstandings and any reason to go back and re-explain anything. And then when he was asked on follow-up, so he didn't have any concerns about there being any misunderstandings. He said, no, I did not. And then he was asked again, but you would at least admit, and this is on cross, you'd at least admit that the conversation was not as fluid as it is now. And he said, no, it was fluid. And then earlier in his testimony, he testified that he was impressed by how well Mr. Acosta Moreno spoke English. He testified that the defendant answered his questions appropriately. He testified that he didn't have any concerns whatsoever about anything in this conversation. And so, as a result, because of that plainly misunderstanding and misremembering of what he had testified, the trial court more or less discards this very crucial testimony about his ability to understand those two English Miranda warnings, and then goes on to look at, well, are there other factors that will help the trial court to determine whether or not this was a knowing and intelligent waiver? I would submit that if the court had gotten that initial ruling correct, the trial court would not have needed to go on to consider other factors because of the significance of an individual's ability to have an hour and a half conversation using fluid and impressive English for an hour and a half, the entire conversation in English, no reasons for any misunderstandings, that alone by itself was enough for the trial court would have concluded that waiver was knowing and intelligent.
How would we overcome the fact that once the Miranda warnings were given in Spanish, in this person's native tongue, that he immediately invoked his rights?
Well, and again, what the standard has been, and this is from the Supreme Court of the United States, is that he knowingly, intelligently, he was aware of the what rights he was waiving and the consequences of that. But the court has gone on to say that that doesn't mean that the defendant has to fully recognize the tactical disadvantages and strategic disadvantages of talking to the police. Otherwise, every Miranda waiver would be overturned later when the defendant realizes that it wasn't a good idea to waive his rights in terms of what might happen when he gets to trial. In this particular case, this defendant was incarcerated for 3 months. In between the time where he had the first interview and they attempted to do the second interview, there's no reason to think he was in solitary confinement and did not have the ability or the opportunity to talk to other individuals who were incarcerated there. And so it would be very reasonable to conclude that he'd talked to someone and somehow at some point realized that it wasn't a good idea to have that conversation in English the first time and to confess to setting this house on fire. And so the second time, 3 months later, he realized this time I'm not going to say anything else, because I've hurt myself enough through this first conversation. I think if the trial court had recognized that he'd had an hour-and-a-half conversation in fluid, impressive English after being read his rights twice in English, the court would have gotten that right and would not have placed nearly as much emphasis on what happened at this second interview 3 months after the fact. I would also submit what opposing counsel is essentially asking the court to do is, and what Your Honor's question kind of implies, is that perhaps the ultimate conclusion could have been right for the wrong reasons. So there may have been these other facts in the record that the court could have relied upon to reach the same result. And I would submit that this is simply not an appropriate case to do a right result, wrong reason doctrine analysis. And I've cited to the court Perry, and of course Perry's less talked about companion case, which is Banks. And Banks, I think, is important because the court clarifies what it means that the record and the trial level has to show that all the necessary factual determinations, which would be necessary for a right result, wrong reason conclusion, have to have been made by the trial court and on the record. And so you don't get the benefit of possible factual findings that the court perhaps could have made unless those factual findings are made on the record. And you also don't get the benefit of reading the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant when that reading of the record was not done on the record by the trial court. And I think the reason for that makes perfect sense. If the court, for example, in a lot of cases, the trial court doesn't state on the record its reasons for its conclusion, and there's no requirement that the court needs to. So in those cases, you would want to read the facts in light most favorable to the defendant. You'd want to give the defendant or the prevailing party, if it's a commonwealth, the benefit of any inferences the court may have made but just chose not to state on the record. But in a case like this where a court states its reasons, and one of its main reasons is plainly wrong, the trial court should not get the benefit of other possible reasons the court might have relied upon. But because the ultimate conclusion and the other facts that were made on the record and those that weren't made on the record are plainly tainted by that one wrong factual finding. So in response to Your Honor's question a moment ago, a lot of the factors that Your Honor mentioned, the trial court never mentioned. The trial court didn't talk about the girlfriend's testimony and what credit the court gave to portions of what the ex-girlfriend would have testified, as opposed to she also would have testified that they spoke English during their relationship. The trial court didn't weigh which parts of her testimony was more persuasive, and as a result, the defendant does not get the benefit of the light most favorable to him if we're doing a right result, wrong reason analysis. Additionally, the trial court didn't talk about, well, he grew up in El Salvador, he was educated over there, he's only been learning English for so long. None of those were factors that the court stated on the records, and none of those turned into fact-finding that is entitled to deference in a right result of wrong reason analysis.
Most of those were stipulated facts, weren't they?
I don't think that they were, Your Honor, with respect. The stipulation was, this is what they would have testified. This is what they would have said. There was never any stipulation that what they would have testified was actually true, was actually correct. Otherwise, I don't think
I'm sorry. I meant by that I thought the stipulated facts included that the defendant was born in El Salvador, attended public school in El Salvador until age 15, that Spanish was his primary language, that he did not read the Spanish card.
The testimony, the statement that he didn't read the Spanish card, I know that in particular was stipulated that that's what he would have testified, not stipulated that that was actually true. I will allow that particular fact that he did not read, according to him, he did not read the Spanish card. That is one of the facts that the Commonwealth is probably stuck with on appeal, because that particular factual finding would have been necessary to the trial court's ultimate conclusion that he didn't understand his rights. Because if he'd read the Spanish card, surely he understood his rights. So that is one that the trial court, I think, did make on the record, and that is entitled to more deference than these other possible factual findings that were not made on the record. However, I would submit that even that is likely tainted by the trial court's plainly wrong finding that the officer had testified that there were misunderstandings during this conversation when there were no misunderstandings.
You're at your five-minute point. You may continue, of course, but I just want you to know you're in your rebuttal time.
All right, well, I will just submit finally that the case cited by my opposing counsel, Garibay, I think supports the Commonwealth's conclusion in this case, even though there the court reached the opposite conclusion and reversed a denial of a motion to suppress. In this case, we're asking the court to do the opposite. But the reasons the court gave in Garibay, the defendants, there were misunderstandings in that case during the interrogation that led to the officer having to re-explain things. So the case was like the trial court in this case thought the testimony was, which led the court to ultimately reverse in Garibay. And also the court in Garibay found that a review of the record revealed the district court incorrectly stated the facts supporting its conclusion, and as a result, clearly erred in concluding that Garibay's English language skills were sufficient for him to understand and waive his constitutional rights. Here we're arguing that the exact same sort of mistake, the trial court's incorrectly stating the facts supporting its conclusion, as a result, led the trial court in this particular case to clearly err in concluding that Mr. Acosta Moreno did not sufficiently understand English for him to waive his constitutional rights. And for those reasons, we're asking this court to reverse, and I'll use whatever rebuttal I have left.
All right. 3 minutes by my count.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Burns?
Yes, may it please the court, Your Honor, Andrew Burns here on behalf of Merari Acosta Moreno. As the Commonwealth just noted in its oral argument, its argument essentially is this argument of taint, and its argument essentially boils down to speculation that if the court had made, you know, not made the statement it made on page 106 of the record regarding Investigator DRC's testimony, that it may have, that it likely would have. Essentially, the Commonwealth has asked this court on an argument to engage in speculation, engage in distribution of weight to the evidence, which this court obviously does not engage in.
I'm sorry, this is Judge O'Brien. Mr. Burns, let me ask you, what is the credible evidence that would cause the judge to determine that the defendant didn't understand?
As your other honor previously cited, there was credible evidence as far as Mr. Acosta Moreno's, as far as his Spanish background being from El Salvador, having never spoken English. And additionally, another fact to that is also that the Commonwealth does bear the burden, and did bear the burden of proof. And accordingly, they bore the burden at the trial court level to establish that he did, in fact, understand.
Do you attach any significance to the fact that when he would conduct phone conversations from the jail, they were conducted in English? Does that weigh at all into this?
I think it's something that the trial court could have given weight to, but clearly the trial court is allowed to give, you know, the trial court's domain is to give weight to evidence, and there was no evidence. Investigator Archie never elaborated on how he was sure that it was Mr. Acosta Moreno, or to what degree the English even was. It could have been one word, it could have been two words, it could have been a long, complex conversation, but there was no testimony given as to what degree of English was even spoken and to what degree he understood it.
Well, Mr. Burns, this is Judge Haley. I believe the word was conversation in English from the jail. Isn't that correct?
I don't recall I believe he says he heard a conversation. Again, that doesn't elaborate on to what depth the conversation was or to what degree his English was. There's certainly Investigator DRC's testimony
that... Well, it's certainly more expansive than your said your speculation that it was one word.
And again, Your Honor, I'm not trying to engage in speculation. I'm just merely noting that the Commonwealth did not establish to what degree it was or wasn't at the trial court level, to what degree English was spoken, and that with the Commonwealth bearing the burden of proof at that level, the Commonwealth has a duty to establish to what degree he may or may not have understood English when he's asserted through his stipulated testimony in this case that he did not understand English that well, and that he did not understand the Miranda warnings that were allegedly read in English. And in looking at that as well, the crux of this case came down to an officer's testimony. Investigator D'Arcy clearly indicated that he elected not to bring a tape recorder. He elected not to bring a Spanish interpreter. And he obtained no written waiver. He supplied no objective evidence upon which the court could say clearly he understood. At that point, he subjected his own testimony and credibility to the court. And although, as the Commonwealth tends to cite, he stated that he was impressed by the English, it was fluent, there were no misunderstandings, he also danced around what Mr. Acosta Moreno's primary language was on page 70 of the record. And at that time, when asked why he had to use the Spanish rights card, why he felt the need to use the Spanish rights card, he stated at that time to make sure there was no confusion. And what the trial court clearly picked up on and was the clear basis of its ruling was that it doesn't make common sense to say that the English is so impressive and there's no difficulties and no misunderstandings there, and then to use a Spanish card to make sure there was no confusion. And then even more so, it's not, the Commonwealth tends to argue that it's this use of an interpreter at a second interrogation. That's not the argument in this case. In this case, Investigator D'Arcy himself testified that the very purpose of bringing Detective Davis to the second interrogation was to make sure that nothing was lost in translation, that there was no misunderstandings, there was no confusion. He had articulated that point to Detective Davis herself, as her testimony corroborated that her understanding of her purpose was to be there to make sure there was no confusion. And those together undermine the credibility of Investigator D'Arcy in his opinion that Mr. Acosta Moreno understood. And looking at the trial court's ruling, what becomes clear from a fair reading of pages 106 to 108 of the record is that the very fact that the Commonwealth is trying to rely on this case, the Commonwealth has made a well-crafted argument to have the court and counsel look at a tree as opposed to looking at the forest. The Commonwealth tends to indicate that this was an important fact to the court, but a fair reading that when the court stated that the detective may have had to re-explain things on page 106 of the record, that was not central to the court's ruling. What the court proceeded to do was to state some facts that the court believed were testified to. But on page 107 of the record, starting with, but I think finally the thing that's causing the court the most concern, is that is clearly that the court's ruling was that although, as it says, couple that with Fire Marshal D'Arcy's testimony that he felt confident, it's clear that the court understood that Investigator D'Arcy's testimony was that, in his opinion, Mr. Acosta Moreno understood, but it begged the question, why would there need to be a need to make sure there was no confusion if he understood?
Well, perhaps, couldn't it be, counsel, that there was a sort of an overabundance of caution along the lines of the fact that he didn't interrogate the defendant the first time when he encountered him because he felt that the defendant was too intoxicated to waive his rights? Are you suggesting that the fact that he brought an interpreter automatically indicates that his testimony that he could understand the defendant is not credible?
No, Your Honor, and I think that's the Commonwealth's twist to defense to the appellee's argument is not the mere fact that an interpreter was brought, but in this instance, as it always is, this question is a question of fact before the court, and in this instance, the issue before the court merely that he brought an interpreter to the second interrogation, but he specifically requested the interpreter to be present for the specific purpose of making sure there was no confusion, misunderstanding, And in that regard, the court made a clear credibility determination, which is the exclusive province of the trial court. And the evidence was clear at multiple times that he felt the need to use the Spanish rights card to make sure there was no confusion. Then he also felt the need to bring an interpreter to make sure there was no confusion. Those undermined his... It suggested to the trial court, as the trial court found, that maybe he was not being forthright in how well the understanding was, or at least that it suggested to the court that there were confusion and misunderstanding to the point that the court did not have the confidence to find that he knowingly and intelligently understood. In that regard, the court properly held the Commonwealth to its burden, as stated in Miranda, that since the Commonwealth is responsible for establishing the circumstances of the interrogation, it has the only means of making available corroborated evidence of warnings, given the nature of the incommunicado interrogation. The Commonwealth didn't supply that in this case. And additionally, that the trial court had an obligation, as stated in the Grog case, to indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver. In this case, the trial court was able to observe Investigator DRC's testimony on these matters and was able to determine that was not clearly credible, and that testimony that he felt confident that he understood was undermined.
Do you suggest that he found that investigator's testimony not credible because of the conclusion he reached? There was nothing where he specifically said that he didn't find the testimony credible. Was there, or are you basing that on his conclusion?
I am, Your Honor. That's based on the implicit finding that can be drawn from his conclusion, is simply that if Investigator Archie felt confident, he noted that it begged the question. And the court's ruling, and going back to that, that's exactly right, that it was implicit within the finding of the court. And going back to the Commonwealth's argument that it was an important part of the court's finding, I would dispute that. And that's based on the bottom of page 107 of the record, where the court says, I think with respect to what I have today, to be able to say, you know, with that statement, that Detective Davis was brought in to avoid any confusion, which, like I said, begs the question, there must have been some indication. There may have been some confusion. And the fact, once you advise the defendant in Spanish, he invoked those rights. To me, based on that, I'm going to grant the motion to suppress. Based on that, nowhere in page 107 or 108 of the record, when the court is clearly articulating the reasons and basis for its decision on the subjective testimony of Investigator Darcy, does it ever state that couple that with the fact that the detective indicated he may have to re-explain things, The court never clearly relied on that, as the Commonwealth tends to portray as its factual finding. The court relied on the fact that Investigator Darcy said he understood and felt confident, but was unable to establish that. He never established, as the Commonwealth bore the burden to prove, that Acosta Moreno knowingly, intelligently understood his rights. He simply had, as the court found, he did not read the card. So as far as English, he never established that he asked him if he waived his rights. He never established that he clearly understood his rights. What was clear is that there was miscommunication, misunderstanding there, as he also felt the need to use a Spanish card. He felt the need to bring the interpreter, not just to bring an interpreter, but for a specific purpose, to make sure there was no confusion or misunderstanding. I don't believe on those facts that a trial court was plainly wrong in making its credibility determinations that are the very essence of the trier of fact, the finder of fact in a case such as this. In addition, the Commonwealth, therefore, if the Commonwealth is now on its appeal brief arguing that the court made a misstatement of fact in its ruling, that its ruling was erroneous, the Commonwealth, under Rule 5A:18, had an obligation, because it was just as erroneous and relevant. If it was, the Commonwealth's argument would be that it was just as erroneous and relevant then. And the Commonwealth never brought this to the trial court's attention to correct that. Accordingly, it's it's actually arguable that the Commonwealth has waived its argument on that basis under Rule 5A, 18. And that the Commonwealth is just merely engaged, is asking this court to engage in speculation and weight-bearing that this court does not engage in.
Anything further, sir?
I'm looking, Your Honor. I don't believe
that. Okay, that's fine. You have a couple of minutes, so take your time if you need it.
I would just reiterate to the court that the Commonwealth in this case is tried to latch on to a statement of apparent fact and then the Commonwealth's argument an erroneous fact. There's nothing in the court's decision to show that tainted. The court clearly made a credibility determination that, and that's all it could do in this case because it had no objective evidence, and it clearly made a finding that it was entitled to make, it has a duty to make, and it is in the best position to make as it's able to observe and see the testimony live, that based on Investigator D'Arcy's responses to the questions, that it indicated there must have been, and begged the question that there was a misunderstanding or confusion at the first interrogation. And that's significant because the Commonwealth bore the burden of proof. And the Commonwealth bears the burden under the standard review on appeal to show that was plainly wrong. And the evidence in this case just does not demonstrate that it was plainly wrong. The fact-finding conducted by the trial court in this case is the very essence of its role and is its exclusive province to determine credibility. I have nothing further at this time unless the court has any further questions.
Nothing from me. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burns. Mr. Chandeville, you have 3 minutes left, and if you can shoehorn it in that 3 minutes, I would appreciate your addressing the contemporaneous objection rule. If there were a misstatement by the trial court, why isn't that waived under 5A18?
Well, Your Honor, I'll address that first and hopefully have time to do a little bit more after the fact. I would submit that the purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is to allow the trial court an opportunity to make a ruling on the issue that is presented on appeal. In this particular case, it's clear that the defendant's ability to have this conversation with the officer in English is one of the facts that was argued to the trial court to support the Commonwealth's position that the court should deny the motion to suppress. It was argued at page 49 in written pleadings, 49 of the appendix, page 94. It was argued orally and also again on page 96. Ultimately, the trial court simply got that wrong and simply gave improper weight to its inaccurate memory of what the officer testified and relied upon that in its ultimate ruling. So in terms of preserving the issue for appeal, while yes, the Commonwealth could have come back and argued again, you know, Your Honor, just so you're clear, you know, this factual finding was incorrect. In terms of actually preserving the issue for appeal and the purpose behind the rule, the trial court had the opportunity to rule on the issue. It was argued to the court. The court clearly did rule on the issue, had an opportunity to get it right, and got it wrong. The Commonwealth would submit that is sufficient to preserve the issue for appeal. And then finally, we would submit that what Acosta Moreno is essentially asking the court to do in this case is to make a credibility determination, or to assume that the trial court made a credibility determination about Lieutenant D'Arcy's testimony that the record plainly establishes the trial court never made. Instead, the trial court relied upon its notes and based on what it had written down in its notes, concluded that Lieutenant D'Arcy testified the opposite of what the record establishes that he actually testified. So we would submit that given those circumstances and the right result on reason doctrine, the court cannot make a credibility determination in order to affirm this case, which was not made on the record, particularly given the significance of the mistake that was made. That probably adds to my argument on whether the issue was preserved, even assuming the court found that the Commonwealth should have come back and raised the issue again, although the issue was clearly before the court the first time. And this would be one of those rare cases where ends of justice would require the court to reverse what the trial court did, because in this particular case, the evidence that was suppressed was based on a clearly and plainly wrong misreading of the facts and misremembering of the facts, and the result was that clear evidence of the defendant's guilt, a clear admission that he committed the crime with which he was charged, was suppressed in this case. So we would submit that that requires the court to reach the issue on this appeal, and that this is not an appropriate case for the right result on reason doctrine under Perry and Banks. We're not asking the court to do any speculation because there was no evidence in the record contradicting Lieutenant Darcy's testimony that they had an hour and a half conversation in English after explaining the rights to him in English twice, and that conversation was clear, that there were no misunderstandings, that he was impressed by the defendant's testimony. There were other factors in the record that were brought up, but nothing contradicted that officer's testimony, and because of the fact that the trial court misremembered what he had actually said, it resulted in a conclusion that was plainly wrong and should be reversed and remanded for trial, and that's what the Commonwealth would ask the court to do here.
Very well. Thank you very much to both of you for a well-written